Hello, hello, hello. I'm Dr. Vivian Low. Welcome back to VLMD Rounds. Now, when I have new patients, many of them have heard that I use low-carb / ketogenic strategies to help improve their health. Oftentimes when they first come to see me, they'll say to me, Dr. Low, I can't go low-carb. And then I'll ask them, why not? And they'll say, well, I get hypoglycemic, right? So I actually have low blood sugar all the time. And it really makes me feel bad. And so I have to eat carbs all day. So I carry sugar with me all day and I have to eat all day. Otherwise, I get such low levels that I get very sick. So I really can't go low carb. I can't cut out the carbs. Which is why I thought then today we should discuss the regulation of blood sugar, especially in relation to low levels of glucose, the condition that we call hypoglycemia. Let's go. Okay, if you have not eaten for 10 to 12 hours, so you know you had dinner at night and then you went to bed and then you didn't eat for 10 to 12 hours. When we wake up and we check the blood sugar levels for you, we would have what we call the fasting blood sugar level. And normally this would be between 75 to 100 milligrams per deciliter. Okay, that's normal fasting blood sugar levels. And in fact, sometimes if it's in the 90 range or closer to 100 after 10 to 12 hours of not eating, you know, I start to pay attention to those patients. It, you know, should be closer to the 75 number in my opinion. All right, but we have that range for fasting blood sugar levels. If we go below the 75, now we have a condition called hypoglycemia. So with hypoglycemia, if your blood sugar level is between 55 to 75, that would be mild hypoglycemia. Most people who have their blood sugar levels in that range, they're really not going to feel it. They're just going to feel normal and not realize that their blood sugar is between 55 to 75. If you fall below that though, now we're getting into like more moderate levels of hypoglycemia. And if you go below the 55 into maybe now the low 40s or 30s, we can get severe hypoglycemia. So below 55, some people will start to get like headaches, blurry vision, nausea, they don't feel well, they're tired, right? They start to get those initial symptoms of hypoglycemia. But if they drop really low into the severe hypoglycemic range, then they could get seizures, they can go into a coma, and obviously this is a life-threatening situation, so you don't want that. Like I said, generally, you know, people tolerate the 55 to 75 range fairly well. However, some people who run high levels of blood sugar most of the time, if you drop that level acutely, right, and you might even drop it still within the normal range or the fasting range, those patients start to have symptoms. So for example, if you have a patient that runs very high, badly controlled diabetes, so running with blood sugar levels of 180 to 200 most of the time, if that level drops acutely to 100, which is still within the normal range, for that patient, they're going to start feeling it and they may start to feel uncomfortable, they may get the headache and so forth, right? Because they're used to much higher levels and now you suddenly dropped it, and they will get symptomatic. But generally, you start to get symptomatic below 55, the headaches and so forth. But when we get into the dangerously low levels, then you could have these life-threatening conditions of seizures and coma. Now, we can't have our blood sugar levels go to zero, obviously, because there are cells in your body, tissues in your body, that rely on glucose as a fuel source. So we talked about the red blood cells, how they don't have mitochondria, so they can't oxidize fats and they rely on glucose as their fuel source. The brain also needs glucose. Fats really can't pass the blood-brain barrier into the brain tissue. And so as a result, your brain is going to rely on glucose. Now, it can use ketone bodies, which do pass the blood-brain barrier. So they can use ketone bodies as a fuel source as well, but they seem to have some preference for glucose. So the brain needs glucose. We have cells in the kidney, the renal medulla, where, you know, those cells also need glucose. Your lens, the cornea of your eye, they require glucose. Testes also require glucose. So these tissues, if you don't have any glucose in your blood, they'd be in serious trouble, right? So we don't want zero. So let's say you had that overnight fast, you woke up and you woke up late and you didn't get a chance to eat breakfast. And you had to sprint for the bus, right? And then you missed the bus, so you started walking and, you know, you finally got to work or got to school, all right? So now you're tired out, you haven't had anything to eat since you woke up, and then you had to run and walk to get to work. And you're going to need some of that glucose. So what will your body do to get you that glucose? Well, let's see. We could look around and see whatever sources of glucose might be around and try to use that. So I told you that we can store glucose in animals in the form of glycogen. And this would be in muscle cells and in liver cells, right? So we can take glucose units, join them together into long branch chains, and that would be the storage form of glucose called glycogen. We find that in liver and in muscle. Now that you need some glucose, why don't we break down some of those stores of glycogen and access glucose that way? Good idea, right? Okay, so we break down the glycogen into glucose. In the liver, you take that glucose that you've now gotten from glycogen, and the process is glycogenolysis, so we broke down the glycogen. That glucose can be used by the liver cells, but they can also go out into the bloodstream so that the other cells in your body can access the glucose, right? So it's for when you break down the glycogen in liver, it's for the liver and for everyone else in the body, all the other cells in the body. Yay! In the muscle, you have glycogen, you can break that down as well. But unfortunately, that glucose cannot be accessed by the rest of the body. And the reason for this is, you know, glucose is kind of stored or trapped in the cell in a form called glucose-6-phosphate. You have that phosphate group and glucose cannot leave the cell. You need a specific enzyme to remove that phosphate group, have free glucose now get out of the cell. And muscle cells lack that enzyme. So they lack that phosphatase enzyme, and therefore they cannot actually get rid of that phosphate bond. And, you know, they can't actually release glucose in its free form out to the bloodstream. So while they have glycogen, they can break that glycogen down, they can have glucose and use that glucose, they can't share it with the rest of the body. Only the liver can do that. So the liver is special that way. All right. So we have all that glycogen, we break it down, wonderful. But then we get to a situation where we have run out of glycogen. You have about 200 to 250 grams of glycogen stored in muscle and liver at any time. And if you run out of it, especially in the liver, because again, muscle can keep using it, but it can't give that glucose to the rest of the body, right? So now you run out of the glycogen stores, what do you do? we're going to have to have a process called gluconeogenesis, neogenesis formation. So we're going to make more glucose now, right, in our body. And this is primarily happening, again, in the liver. See, liver is very special that way, right? So we are going to depend on the liver for gluconeogenesis. All right, so how are we going to go about this? If you remember from the first episode, I talked about how glucose is a six-carbon compound, right? And it enters into the cell, and we take it through this process of glycolysis. And in that process, we are breaking the six-carbon glucose into two three-carbon units called pyruvate, P-Y-R-U-V-A-T-E, pyruvate. So we take six carbons, and we run it through glycolysis, and we end up with two three-carbon pyruvate units, right? Now, each pyruvate can then actually enter into the Krebs cycle. First, it loses another carbon, it becomes acetyl-CoA, and then it enters into the Krebs cycle. Okay, let's just pause a minute here and kind of go through the Krebs cycle a little bit. I avoided talking too much about the specific intermediates in the Krebs cycle in episode one. But, you know, that's because it was just the first episode. I didn't want to overload everyone with too many technicalities. But it would be worthwhile to just kind of look at some of those intermediates right now. So you have your acetyl-CoA, and it's going to combine with oxaloacetate, and we're going to form citric acid. Eventually, that citric acid becomes alpha-ketoglutarate, and that becomes succinyl-CoA, which becomes succinate, fumarate, malate, back to oxaloacetate, which is now ready to take on another acetyl-CoA and form citric acid again. And we cycle around in that clockwise direction in the Krebs cycle. All right, so we have all these intermediates. I did say in episode one, you can think of the Krebs cycle as a place where we harvest electrons and hydrogen so that we can carry them to the inner mitochondrial membrane where the electron transport chain sits, and then we are going to eventually make ATP that way, which is a currency of energy in the cell. All right, so that was one of the purposes of the Krebs cycle, but I also mentioned in that episode that it's very important too that we have those intermediates or substrates within the Krebs cycle. Those are very important for various biochemical processes in the body. All right, so we're going to need to refer to that cycle for gluconeogenesis as well. Okay, so as I said, pyruvate, right, becomes acetyl-CoA, which is two carbons, and then it gets loaded onto oxaloacetate, which is four carbons, and then it makes the citric acid, which is six carbons. And then we cycle through. You don't really have to remember all of that right now. But the point is that the pyruvate enters into the cycle, and it cycles in that clockwise direction, going the route that I just described previously. Well, if we're going to go and make glucose, let's see. We first took glucose and then we broke it down into two molecules of pyruvate, which then entered the Krebs cycle. What if we took the pyruvate and somehow ran that pathway of glycolysis backwards to get back to glucose? Isn't that a good idea? Actually, it's not a bad idea, except for one problem, okay? So imagine you want to go from town A to town E. So you get in your car and you drive from town A to town E, and you get through town B, C, D, and eventually you arrive in town E. Okay, when it's time for you to do the return trip, however, you can't just get in your car and drive back the same way you came. And the reason for that is that along that route, there were several parts of the route that were actually one-way streets, right? So only one-way traffic. So now when you want to return from E to A, you can get on that route, but when you come to those points where it's only one-way traffic, you're going to have to do something else. So what you would do at that point is make a detour and go around. Eventually, you'll come back to the route again, and then you'll proceed until you get to another one-way traffic point, and then you're going to have to detour again and then get back on the route, right? And if you do it that way, you'll eventually get back to town A, but not exactly the same way that you came, okay? And that's kind of the same with this reverse glycolysis. So pyruvate can't just go backwards directly and make glucose. However, what it can do is it can enter into the Krebs cycle, and there's an enzyme that will take pyruvate and make it into oxaloacetate. So in the end, usually pyruvate, you know, is combined with oxaloacetate to make citric acid, usually. But here, what we can do is take pyruvate and make it oxaloacetate. So we're kind of going backwards in the cycle. That oxaloacetate now can continue running backwards in the Krebs cycle, and it becomes malate. Now, malate is a sneaky substance because malate can sneak out of the mitochondria. Remember, the Krebs is occurring within the mitochondria, and the inner mitochondrial membrane is quite impermeable. But malate is pretty sneaky, and it can get outside of the mitochondria. So malate will sneak out of the mitochondria back into the cytoplasm. And in the cytoplasm, it can be converted back to oxaloacetate. And oxaloacetate can be converted to a form of pyruvate called phosphoenolpyruvate. So that was the detour that we made. And now we get back on the glycolytic pathway, reverse it, right? And then there are other one-way streets ahead, but we'll do the same little detours, okay? And eventually we can get our way back to glucose. So it's kind of reverse glycolysis with those detours included, okay? So that's how we could make glucose. All right. Now, the other thing we can do with pyruvate, I told you, is that, you know, under certain circumstances, we can take pyruvate and make it into lactate, right? And once we make lactate, what we do is, in that process, we're actually going to, remember the energy carriers, NAD, NADH? Well, with lactate, you can take, with the formation of lactate, we take NADH and we make NAD, right? And that's really important. Why? Because really, for glycolysis and for the Krebs cycle, we need a lot of NAD. And sometimes in conditions where you don't have a lot of oxygen, right, that whole process is going to stall. But if we take pyruvate and we run it to lactate, we're going to generate some NAD that way and allow glycolysis to continue. So it's kind of like a little rescue pathway, right? So it's very important that we can make lactate. Well, we can take that lactate now. We could run that backwards too and bring it back to pyruvate and then do that reverse glycolysis pathway and get back to glucose, okay? So that's not a bad idea, and we can do that, okay? And actually, there is a kind of crosstalk between liver and muscle, which involves lactate. So in the muscle cells, we have glucose running through the glycolytic pathway, and we end up with pyruvate, right? And let's say you're doing some manual labor, or you've been working out hard in the gym, right? And now you accumulate some lactate, you make some lactate in the muscle. Well, that lactate can get out into the bloodstream. It gets back to the liver. The liver now can take that lactate and convert it back to pyruvate. And then we do that reverse glycolysis pathway, kind of, to get back to glucose. Once you have glucose, the liver can release that glucose into the bloodstream. It gets back to the muscle, and the muscle can use that glucose again, right? So that's a nice kind of cycle between muscle and liver that we call the Cori cycle, C-O-R-I, the Cori cycle. Okay, so those are some ways that we can make glucose. But we can also use other substances to make glucose. We can use amino acids. So sometimes people think that, if you don't eat carbs, then, you don't really have glucose in your bloodstream. And that's not true, because when you break down proteins into amino acids, some of those amino acids can be converted into glucose, okay? Those amino acids are called glucogenic amino acids, and the most glucogenic amino acid is alanine. Okay, alanine is really good for making glucose. Alanine is essentially converted to pyruvate, and then that pyruvate can run that reverse glycolysis pathway, and we get back to glucose, right? So there is another cycle between muscle and liver, and this involves alanine. So the muscle takes in glucose, runs it through the glycolytic pathway. We end up with pyruvate, and then we have a biochemical reaction, transamination, and from that pyruvate, we make alanine, the amino acid alanine. Alanine gets out into the bloodstream, eventually gets to the liver. The liver can take that alanine, okay, and then make it into pyruvate. And that pyruvate now runs backwards along the glycolytic pathway. We get glucose in the end. That glucose is released by the liver cell into the bloodstream, and it goes back to the muscle, and the muscle can make that cycle happen all over again. And this cycle is called the Cahill cycle, C-A-H-I-L-L, the Cahill cycle. So the Cori cycle is with lactate between the liver and the muscle, and the Cahill cycle is with alanine between the liver and also the muscle. All right, there are other amino acids that can be used for gluconeogenesis. And glutamine, for example, okay, glutamine, arginine, histidine, proline, these can be converted to alpha-ketoglutarate, which is a substrate in the Krebs cycle, right? So they can be converted to alpha-ketoglutarate, and we can run that to succinate eventually. Eventually gets to malate, and remember, malate can get out into the cytoplasm, be converted to oxaloacetate, and then converted to a form of pyruvate called phosphoenolpyruvate, run the glycolytic pathway backwards and get back to glucose. Okay, so alpha-ketoglutarate, very useful substrate in the Krebs cycle. Now we can also make glucose from fats, right? Interesting, right? So the stored form of fats in our body is triglycerides or triacylglycerols. Essentially, we take glucose and we make along the glycolytic pathway something called glyceraldehyde, which can now be made into glycerol. This glycerol can now attach to three fatty acids, right? It forms a backbone and then attaches to three fatty acids, and that is called a triglyceride or triacylglycerol, okay? when we break down the triglycerides, we essentially break it down into its component parts. So now we break them down into fatty acids, and then the glycerol. We can oxidize the fats, but we can use that glycerol, convert it back to glyceraldehyde, right, which is part of the glycolytic pathway, and then run that backwards, and voila, guess what? We can make glucose, right? Useful. So now we can use fats to make glucose. We can also make glucose from a substance called propionyl-CoA. Propionyl-CoA. This comes about as a from the breakdown of cholesterol. So as we're making cholesterol into bile acids, we form propionyl-CoA. Okay, and certain amino acids can also become propionyl-CoA, valine, isoleucine, methionine. Those ones can become propionyl-CoA. But we can also get propionyl-CoA from the oxidation of odd chain fatty acids. So fatty acids that have an odd number of carbon chains, like a C19, right, or C21. When you oxidize those types of fatty acids, you will get propionyl-CoA. The propionyl-CoA can now enter into the Krebs cycle again as succinyl-CoA becomes succinate, and then we can eventually access that reverse glycolytic pathway also. So what I want you to notice now is that we have made glucose from non-carbohydrate precursors, right, through pyruvate and lactate, and also through certain glucogenic amino acids, through triglycerides and propionyl-CoA. So we started with non-carbohydrate precursors to end up with glucose, and that is what happens in gluconeogenesis. One other thing I want to add is that if you have a situation where there's a lot of alcohol on board, so in the case of alcohol intoxication, you can actually inhibit gluconeogenesis, which would make it a life-threatening situation, because if you inhibit gluconeogenesis, then you are not making glucose. Your glucose levels will drop dangerously low, and you can have seizures and go into a coma. So we worry about that when someone has had a lot of alcohol on board. That alcohol is going to be metabolized to aldehyde and eventually acetate. In the process of doing this, we are going to make a lot of NADH, okay? We're going to make a lot of NADH. What do we make? What do we need, though, for gluconeogenesis? We need NAD, right? So now your cell has a lot of NADH and very little NAD in comparison. But if we're going to, for example, take lactate back to pyruvate, we're going to need some NAD for that, right? And if we don't have NAD around, you can't run that pathway. And so you really can't run the process of gluconeogenesis, right? What about the substrates, the intermediates in the Krebs cycle, right? So you have some alpha-ketoglutarate that you made, let's say, from glutamine, right? But we need to run that cycle all the way to malate. We will be needing some NAD, okay? And if you don't have enough NAD, then, okay, you can't do that either, right? So you can see how that can be a dangerous situation. So, you know, watch out. If you have a patient with alcohol intoxication, you do worry that they may be inhibiting gluconeogenesis. Okay, moving on. Now, the next thing we're going to talk about is how some hormones will regulate the low blood sugar levels, okay, by raising your blood sugar, okay? So these are called hyperglycemic hormones, and there are various hormones that can do that, growth hormone, ACTH, thyroxine. These can help raise your blood sugar levels. You have these stress hormones. So when you're under a lot of stress, let's say you're meeting the saber-toothed tiger and you have to, you know, run or fight, run from or fight the saber-toothed tiger. And, you know, probably it's unfair to keep using the saber-toothed tiger. So what if you met your boss or your mother-in-law, your father-in-law, and you need to run or fight them? Probably don't recommend that. Then you're going to need some excess energy, and your adrenal glands, which sit on top of your kidneys, will secrete both cortisol and epinephrine. And these hormones can help you access glucose in an acute situation, in a stress situation. And they do that generally by increasing the breakdown of glycogen. So they encourage the breakdown of glycogen both in liver and also in muscle, right? And they also inhibit the formation of glycogen. So you're not storing glucose in the form of glycogen, you're actually breaking it down so that we access that glucose in the bloodstream. Okay, so that's how you could raise your blood sugar levels under those circumstances. The most hyperglycemic hormone is really glucagon, G-L-U-C-A-G-O-N. That is the most important hormone for raising your blood sugar levels, because glucagon will act on the liver to increase the process of gluconeogenesis, stimulate gluconeogenesis. So glucagon is really very important. It is made in the pancreas. Now the pancreas is an organ that sits behind your stomach, and it has two main functions, an exocrine function and an endocrine function. Exocrine function just means it secretes digestive enzymes to help you digest food. Great. But it also has an endocrine function, which means that it secretes hormones. So if you looked at the pancreas, you would see these areas that look like little islands on the pancreas. And so they're called islets of Langerhans. They're named after the person who discovered them, and they're called islets of Langerhans. And that's where the hormone-producing cells are found, in the pancreas. You have different types. But for glucagon, we are going to focus on these cells that are called the alpha cells of the islets of Langerhans. Okay, the alpha cells. Now, these alpha cells make and store glucagon in the cell, and the glucagon is sort of prepackaged in this little vesicle or this little compartment, okay? And it's sitting in the cell, and only when you need to raise your blood sugar level will you release this prepackaged glucagon into the bloodstream. So let's see how that's done. Okay, because that's really interesting. So your alpha cells can take in glucose, probably through GLUT1, right? Like most other cells in the body, it will have GLUT1 transporters, and it'll take in glucose into the cell that way. So when glucose gets into the cell, let's say you have a lot of glucose in the blood, and therefore, a lot of glucose will go into the alpha cell. And when you have a lot of glucose, then you can take that glucose, you can run it through glycolysis, make pyruvate and then acetyl-CoA, and then run it through the Krebs cycle and generate a lot of energy in the form of ATP. Wonderful, right? So now you have a lot of ATP accumulating in the cell. Okay. A couple of things you need to know about the cell. First, the interior of the cell is a lot more negative than the exterior of the cell. So the environment inside the cell is more negatively charged than outside the cell. Okay, that's a general rule. Also, we tend to have potassium inside cells, intracellularly, rather than in the bloodstream, for example, or outside the cell. Okay, so we have more potassium in the cell And we also have the interior of the cell more negatively charged than the exterior of the cell. Those are the general rules. In the membrane of the alpha cells, you have these potassium channels. And what they do is they control the entry and, well, the movement of potassium in and out of the cell. Right, so when we have a situation where we have a pileup or an accumulation of the ATP, this will cause the potassium channels to open. Okay, and when those channels are open, guess what? Potassium, which is positively charged, can leave the cell. All right. Remember, overall, the cell is more negatively charged than inside than outside. It has potassium, more potassium inside, and potassium is actually a positively charged ion. But despite the fact that it's positively charged, the general overall interior of the cell is still more negatively charged than outside. Okay, but if this channel is open and the potassium now is able to leave the cell, so you have these positive charges leave the cell, then that cell is going to become even more negatively charged as a result, right? Because the positive ions left. And now it's even more negatively charged. And the cell membrane becomes hyperpolarized. Okay, now there are these channels that are different channels sitting on the cell membrane that are called voltage-gated calcium channels. And these are able to sense the voltage across the membrane, okay? And now that the cell is hyperpolarized, that channel is going to say, I think I'm going to remain closed and I'm not going to allow calcium into the cell, all right? When calcium gets into the cell, it will trigger the release of glucagon into the bloodstream. But because there's a lot of ATP, then the potassium channels are open, potassium leaves the cell becomes even more negatively charged, right, inside. And now that membrane potential signals these voltage-gated calcium channels to stay close. There's just too much ATP around. Don't let any calcium in. Okay? What happens when glucose levels drop? Well, then we actually have the opposite situation now. So there's not a lot of glucose entering into the cell. So, you know, you don't generate a lot of ATP and there's a drop in ATP in the cell. And those potassium channels sense that drop. And as a result, they close. And when they close, they're basically keeping potassium inside the cell. Now potassium cannot leave, right? And remember, potassium is positively charged. So what's going to happen is, although the cell is still more negative relative to inside relative to the outside, right? It does have more potassium now, which are positively charged ions. It does have more potassium inside now. So it still is negatively charged, but less so, right? Less so. And this is going to change the membrane potential. Now that membrane becomes depolarized and the voltage changes and those voltage-gated calcium channels are able to sense that. And the minute they sense that, they open up and they allow calcium to flow into the cell. And this entry of calcium will trigger the release of these prepackaged glucagon units into the bloodstream. Brilliant, no? I mean, I think it's just amazing that the cell knows what to do just by sensing the energetics, right? Because now we don't have a lot of ATP. Ooh, glucose must be low. We'll close the channel, make the cell a little less negative, change the voltage across the membrane, allow calcium to come in, release the glucagon. The glucagon can now get to the liver and stimulate that process of gluconeogenesis. our bodies are really amazing. Okay, let's just do our wrap up right now. Okay, we talked about fasting blood sugar levels being 75 to 100 milligrams per deciliter. If you go below the 75, the range of 55 to 75 would put you in the mild hypoglycemic state, and generally that's asymptomatic. You go below 55 and you're in moderate hypoglycemia and people will start to have symptoms. If you go well below that, let's say you get into the low 40s and the 30s, then you could have life-threatening seizures or coma. Okay, that would be severe hypoglycemia. Now, your body has ways to protect you against that. You have tissues in your body that are really depending on glucose for fuel. That would be the mitochondria, the brain, the parts of the kidney, and your eyes and the testes. So those require glucose. So your body has a way to generate more glucose. The first thing it's going to do is go to its stores of glucose in the form of glycogen. We can find glycogen in the liver and also in the muscle. And take that glycogen and break it down into the individual glucose units. In the liver, we can take that glucose and release it into the bloodstream so that other cells can access that glucose. In the muscle, we can't, because muscle lacks the enzyme to release free glucose into the bloodstream. So the muscle cell can use that glucose that it generates from glycogen, from the breakdown of glycogen, but it can't actually help other cells get glucose that way. All right. We can now make glucose through a process called gluconeogenesis. And the way we can do that is we can sort of run the glycolytic pathway backwards. It's not exactly the same as just directly reversing glycolysis, because there are certain steps that are irreversible along the glycolytic pathway, certain sort of one-way traffic, one-way streets along that pathway. And we will have to do some detours and eventually get back on the pathway, and then do another detour and get back on the pathway, and then inch our way back to glucose that way from pyruvate, all right? One way we do that is we access the Krebs cycle so that we eventually get a substrate that can get out into the cytoplasm. That would be malate. Malate can convert back to oxaloacetate, and then eventually we can access the glycolytic pathway and go backwards to glucose that way. We can also take lactate and make it back into pyruvate and run the glycolytic pathway backwards. Now, the other thing we can do to make glucose is to start with glucogenic amino acids. The most glucogenic amino acid is alanine. And alanine essentially can be made into pyruvate, and then you can again do that reverse glycolysis to get glucose. There is crosstalk between the liver and muscle, and we can cycle lactate in the Cori cycle. We can cycle alanine in the Cahill cycle between muscle and liver. There are other amino acids that you can use to do gluconeogenesis. So glutamine, for example, can become alpha-ketoglutarate and enter into Krebs cycle, and then again eventually make its way through that process of reverse glycolysis back to glucose. Besides amino acids, we can also use fats for gluconeogenesis, and that's because the triglycerides, which is the way we store fats in our body, the triglycerides can be broken down into fatty acids and glycerol. Glycerol can be converted back to glyceraldehyde, part of the intermediates in the glycolytic pathway, and then we can run that back to glucose that way as well. We can also use propanol-CoA from the breakdown of cholesterol into bile acids, from the breakdown of certain amino acids, and also from the oxidation of odd-chain fatty acids. So we make this propionyl-CoA, which can become succinyl-CoA, enter into the Krebs cycle, succinate, and to fumarate and so forth, and then we can run that glycolytic pathway backwards also. So gluconeogenesis really doesn't involve just one pathway, although there are some commonalities, right, depending on what substrates you start with. But gluconeogenesis, also important to remember, is that we are making glucose from non-carbohydrate precursors. Okay, then we went on to hormonal regulation of blood sugar levels. And when your blood sugar levels fall very low, then the alpha cells in your pancreas will secrete glucagon. And the way they do that is they detect the amount of glucose. They take in glucose from the bloodstream. And if there's a lot of glucose, they make a lot of ATP. That ATP will kind of be a sensor for these potassium channels that sit in the membrane. If there's a lot of ATP, the channel is going to remain open and potassium will leave the cell. And potassium is positively charged. When it leaves the cell becomes even more negatively charged, and that changes the membrane potential. There are other channels called voltage-gated calcium channels that can sense that, and when there's a lot of ATP, it will keep the channel closed and not allow calcium in to release the glucagon. In the opposite situation, when there's low ATP in the cell, then the potassium channels are going to close, keeping potassium in the cell, making the cell now relatively less negative than before. And again, that changes the membrane potential, and the voltage across that membrane will change. Those voltage-gated channels will sense that and open, allowing calcium to flood into the cell and release glucagon into the bloodstream. Glucagon will go and stimulate gluconeogenesis in the liver. Okay, we got through that. All right, so we will continue with regulation of blood sugar levels in our next episode. And this time we'll look at the reverse situation when we have high levels of glucose in the bloodstream. But for today, we're done. So signing out from VLMD Rounds, I am Dr. Vivian Lowe. Thank you for joining me. I sing the body electric. Bye-bye.